Back in Schoon Avenue, Vimes and Sybil generally took only one meal a day together, in the kitchen, which was always pleasantly snug by then. They sat facing one another at the table, which was long enough to carry Vimes's huge collection of sauce bottles, mustard pots, pickles, and, of course, chutneys. Vimes being of the popular persuasion that no jar of pickles is ever truly empty if you rattle the spoon around inside it long enough. Things were different at the Hall. For one thing, there was far too much food. Vimes had not been born yesterday, or even the day before, and refrained from commenting. Willikins served Vimes and Lady Sybil. Strictly speaking, it wasn't his job while they were away from home, but strictly speaking, most gentlemen's gentlemen didn't carry a set of brass knuckles in their well-cut jacket either. "And what did you boys do this morning?" said Sybil cheerfully, as the plates were emptied. "We saw the stinky bone man," said young Sam. "He was like all beard but stinky, and we found the smelly apple tree which is like poo." Lady Sybil's placid expression did not change. "And then you came down the roly-poly hill, didn't you? And what about the ha-ha, the ho-ho, and the hee-hee?" "Yes, but there's all cow poo. I treaded in it." Young Sam waited for an adult response, and his mother said, "Well, you've got your new country boots, haven't you? Treading in cow poo is what they're for." Sam Vimes watched his son's face glow with impossible pleasure as his mother went on, "Your grandfather always told me that if I saw a big pile of muck in a field, I should kick it around a bit so as to spread it evenly, because that way all the grass will grow properly." She smiled at Vimes's expression and said, "Well, it's true, dear. A lot of farming is about manure." "Just so long as he understands that he doesn't start kicking up the gutters when he gets back to the city," Vimes said. "Some of that stuff will kick back." "He should learn about the countryside. He should know where food comes from and how we get it. This is important, Sam." "Of course, dear." Lady Sybil gave her husband a look only a wife can give. "That was your put-upon but dutiful voice, Sam." "Yes, but I don't see—" Sybil interrupted him. "Young Sam will own all this one day, and I'd like him to have some idea about it all, just as I'd like you to relax and enjoy your holiday. I'm taking young Sam over to Home Farm later on to see the cows being milked and to collect some eggs." She stood up. "But first, I'm going to take him down to the crypt to see his ancestors." She noted her husband's look of panic and added quickly, "It's all right, Sam. They aren't walking around. They are, in fact, in very expensive boxes. Why don't you come too?" Sam Vimes was no stranger to death, and vice versa. It was the suicides that got him down. They were mostly hangings, because you would have to be extremely suicidal to jump into the River Ank, not least because you would bounce several times before you broke through the crust. And they all had to be investigated, just in case it was a murder in disguise. More than once, watchmen had found handwritten suicide notes, which, on careful examination, weren't in the right handwriting. And whereas Mr. Trooper, the current city hangman, could drop someone into eternity so quickly and smoothly that they probably didn't notice, too often Vimes had seen what amateurs managed to do. The Ramkin family crypt reminded him of the city morgue after hours. It was crowded, some coffins were stacked edgewise as though they were on shelves in the mortuary, but it was to be hoped they didn't slide out. Vimes watched warily as his wife carefully took their son from plaque to plaque, reading out the names and explaining a little about every occupant, and he felt the cold, bottomless depths of time around him somehow breathing from the walls. How could it feel for young Sam to know the names of all those grandfathers and grandmothers down the centuries? Vimes had never known his father. His mum told him that the man had been run over by a cart, but Vimes suspected that if this was true at all, then it was probably a brewer's cart, which had run him over a bit at a time for years. Oh, of course, there was old Stoneface, the regicide, now rehabilitated, and with his own statue in the city, which was never graffitied because Vimes had made it clear what would happen to the perpetrator. But old Stoneface was just a point in time, a kind of true myth. There wasn't a line between him and Sam Vimes, only an aching gulf. Still, young Sam would be a duke one day, and that was a thought worth hanging on to. He wouldn't grow up worrying about what he was, because he would know, and the influence of his mother might just outweigh the enormous drag factor of having Samuel Vimes as a father. Young Sam would be able to shake up the world the right way. You need confidence to do that, and having a bunch of apparently loony but interesting ancestors could only impress the man in the street, and Vimes knew a lot of streets and a lot of men. Willikins hadn't entirely told the truth. Even city people liked a character, especially a black-hearted one or one interesting enough to materially add to the endless, crazy circus show which was the street life of Ankh Morpork. And while having a drunkard for a father was a social faux pas, having a great-great-great-grandfather who could drink so much brandy that his urine must surely have been inflammable, and then, according to Willikins, proceeded to go home to a meal of turbot followed by roast goose with appropriate wines, and then played a hand of saddle pork with his cronies until dawn, winning back his earlier losses. Saddle pork was invented sometime around the year of the stoat by Reverend Joseph Causality Robinson, rector of All Saints and Three Sinners in the parish of Lower Overhang. As far as can be determined from notes made by his contemporaries, the game may be considered an amalgam of spillikins, halma, and brandy. No known rules exist, if, indeed, there ever really were any. Well, people loved that sort of thing, and that sort of person, who kicked the world in the arse and shouted at it. That was an ancestor to be proud of, surely. "I think I'd like to go for a walk by myself," said Vimes. "You know, have a look round, poke about a bit, get the hang of this countryside business at my own pace." "Willikins ought to accompany you, dear," said Lady Sybil, "just in case." "In case of what, my dear? I walk around the streets of the city every night, don't I? I don't think I need a chaperone for a stroll in the country, do I? I'm trying to get into the spirit of things. I'll look at daffodils to see if they fill me with joy or whatever it is they're supposed to do, and keep an eye open for the very rare grebe warbler and watch the moles take flight. I've been reading the nature notes in the paper for weeks. I think I know how to do this by myself, dear. The commander of the watch is not afraid to spot the spotted flycatcher." Lady Sybil had learned from experience when it was wise not to argue, and contented herself with saying, "Don't upset anybody at least, will you, dear?" After 10 minutes of walking, Vimes was lost. Not physically lost, but metaphorically, spiritually, and peripatetically lost. The fragrances of the hedgerows were somehow without body compared with the robust stinks of the city, and he had not the faintest idea what was rustling in the undergrowth. He recognised heifers and bullocks because he often walked through the slaughterhouse district, but the ones out here weren't bewildered by fear and stared at him carefully as he walked past as if they were calmly taking notes. Yes, that was it. The world was back to front. He was a copper. He had always been a copper, and he would die a copper. You never stopped being a copper, on the whole. And as a copper, he walked around the city more or less invisible, except to those people who made it their business to spot coppers, and whose livelihood depends upon their spotting coppers before coppers spot them. Mostly, you were part of the scenery, until the scream, the tinkle of broken glass, and the sound of felonious footsteps brought you into focus. But here, everything was watching him. Things darted away behind a hedge, flew up in panic, or just rustled suspiciously in the undergrowth. He was the stranger, the interloper, not wanted here. He turned another corner, and there was the village. He had seen the chimneys some way off, but the lanes and footpaths criss-crossed one another in a tangle, repeated in the overflowing hedgerows and trees that made tunnels of shade, which were welcome, and played merry hells with his sense of direction, which was not. He had lost all his bearings, and was hot and bothered by the time he came out into a long dusty lane with thatched cottages on either side, and halfway down a large building which had "pub" written all over it, particularly by the three old men who were sitting on the bench outside it, eyeing the approaching Vimes hopefully, in case he was the kind of man who would buy another man a pint. They wore clothes that looked as if they had been nailed on. Then, when he got closer, one said something to the other two, and they stood up as he passed, index fingers touching their hat-brims. One of them said, "Gartnoon, your Grace," a phrase which Vimes interpreted after a little thought. There was also a slight and meaningful tip of the empty tankards, to indicate that they were, in fact, empty tankards, and therefore an anomaly in need of rectification. Vimes knew what was expected of him. There wasn't a pub in Ankh Morpork which didn't have the equivalent three old men sunning themselves outside and ever ready to talk to strangers about the good old days, i.e. when the tankards they were nursing still had beer in them. And the form was that you filled them up with cheap ale and got a, "Well, thank you, kind sir," and quite possibly little bubbles of information about who had been seen where, doing what, and with whom and when, all grist to the copper's mill. But the expressions on these three changed when another of them whispered hurriedly to his cronies, They pushed themselves back on the wooden seat, as if trying to make themselves inconspicuous, while still clasping the empty flagons because, well, you never knew. A sign over the door proclaimed that this was the Goblin's Head. Opposite the pub was a large open space laid, as they say, to grass. A few sheep grazed on it, and towards the far end was a large stack of wood like wicker hurdles, the purpose of which Vimes could not guess. He was, however, familiar with the term village green, although he had never seen one. Hank Morpork wasn't very big on greens. The pub smelled of stale beer. This helped as a bulwark against temptation, although Vimes had been clean for years, and could face the occasional sherry at official events, because he hated the taste of it anyway. The smell of antique beer had the same effect. By the pitiful light of the tiny windows, Vimes made out an elderly man industriously polishing a tankard. The man looked up at Vimes and gave him a nod, the basic nod which is understood everywhere as meaning, "I see you, you see me, it's up to you what happens next." Although some publicans can put an inflection on a nod, which also manages to convey the information that there might just be a 2-foot length of lead piping under the counter, should the party of the second part want to start anything, as it were. Vimes said, "Do you serve anything that isn't alcoholic?" The barman very carefully hung the tankard on a hook over the bar, and then looked directly at Vimes and said, without rancour, "Well, you see, sir, this is what we call a pub. People get stuffy about it if I leaves out the alcohol." He drummed his fingers on the bar for a moment and went on uncertainly, "My wife makes root beer, if that takes your fancy." "What kind of root?" "Beetroot, as it happens, sir. It's good for keeping you regular." "Well, I've always thought of myself as a regular kind of person," said Vimes. "Give me a pint." "No, make that half a pint, thanks." There was another nod, and the man disappeared briefly behind the scenes and came back with a large glass overflowing with red foam. "There you go," he said, putting it carefully on the bar. "We don't put it in pewter because it does something to the metal. This one is on the house, sir. My name is Jiminy, landlord of the Goblin's Head. I dare say I know yours. My daughter is a maid at the big house, and I treat every man alike, the reason being that the publican is a friend to any man with money in his pockets, and also, if the whim takes him, perhaps even to those who temporarily find themselves stony broke, which does not, at the moment, include them three herberts outside. The publican sees all men after a couple of pints, and sees no reason to discriminate." Jiminy winked at Vimes, who held out his hand and said, "Then I'll happily shake the hands of a republican." Vimes was familiar with the ridiculous litany. Every man who served behind a bar thought of himself as one of the world's great thinkers, and it was wise to treat him as such. After the handshake, he added, "This juice is pretty good, rather tangy." "Yes, sir, my wife puts chili peppers in it, and celery seed to make the man think he's drinking something with bones in." Vimes leaned on the counter, inexplicably at peace. The wall over the bar was hung with the heads of dead animals, particularly those possessed of antlers and fangs, but it came as a shock to spot, in the grubby light, a goblin's head. "I'm on holiday," he thought, "and that probably happened a long time ago. Ancient history," and he left it at that. Jiminy busied himself with the dozens of little tasks that a barman can always find to do, while occasionally glancing at his single customer. Vimes thought for a moment and said, "Can you take a pint to those gentlemen outside, Mr. Jiminy, and put a brandy in each one so that a man knows he's drinking something?" "That would be Long Tom, Short Tom, and Tom Tom," said Jiminy, reaching for some mugs. "Decent lads, triplets, as it happens. They earn their keep, but, as you might say, they shared one brain out between all three of them, and it wasn't that good a brain to start with. Very good when it comes to scaring crows, though."
"And we're all named Tom," said Vimes.
"That's right. It's by way of being a family name, see, their dad being called Tom also. Maybe it saves confusion, them being easily confused. They're getting on a bit now, of course, but if you give them a job they can do, then they'll do it well, and won't stop until you tell them to. No beggars in the countryside, see? There's always little jobs that need doing. By your leave, sir, I'll give them short measure on the brandy. They don't need too much confusion, if you get my drift."
The publican put the mugs on a tray and disappeared out into the bright sunshine. Vimes moved swiftly behind the bar and back again without stopping. A few seconds later, he was leaning nonchalantly on the counter as three faces peeped in through the open door. With a look of some apprehension, three thumbs-up salutes were aimed at Vimes, and the faces were hauled back out of sight again, presumably in case he exploded or developed horns. Jiminy came back with the empty tray and gave Vimes a cheerful smile. "Well, you've made some friends there, sir, but don't let me keep you. I'm sure you've a lot to do."
A copper, thought Vimes. "I recognise a police trench when I see one. That's the copper's dream, isn't it, to leave the streets behind and run a little pub somewhere. Because you're a copper, and because being a copper never leaves you, you will know what is going on."
"I know you, and you don't know that I do. And from where I'm sitting, I call that a result. You wait, Mr. Jiminy. I know where you live."
Now Vimes could hear slow and heavy footsteps in the distance, getting closer. He saw the local men as they arrived in their working clothes and carrying what most people would call agricultural implements, but which Vimes mentally noted as offensive weapons. The troop stopped outside the door, and now he heard whispering. The three Toms were imparting today's news, apparently, and it seemed to be received with either incredulity or scorn. Some sort of conclusion was being reached, not happily. And then the men trooped in, and Vimes's mind clocked them for ready reference. Exhibit 1 was an elderly man with a long white beard, and, good heavens, a smock. Did they really still wear those? Whatever his name, the others probably called him Grandad. He shyly touched his finger to his forehead in salute, and headed for the bar, job safely done. He had been carrying a big hook, not a nice weapon. Exhibit 2 carried a shovel, which could be an axe or a club if a man knew what he was doing. He was smocked up too, didn't catch Vimes's eye, and his salute had been more like a begrudged wave. Exhibit 3, who was holding a toolbox, terrific weapon if swung accurately, scurried past with speed and barely glanced in Vimes' direction. He looked young and rather weedy, but nevertheless you can get good momentum on one of those boxes. Then there was another elderly man wearing a blacksmith's apron, but the wrong build, so Vimes marked him down as a farrier. Yes, that would be it, short and wiry, would easily be able to get under a horse. The man presented a reasonable attempt at a forelock salute, and Vimes was unable to make out any dangerous bulges concealed by the apron. He couldn't help this algebra. It was what you did when you did the job. Even if you didn't expect trouble, you, well, expected trouble. And then the room froze. There had been some desultory conversation in the vicinity of Jiminy, but it stopped now as the real blacksmith came in. Bugger. All Vimes's warning bells rang at once, and they weren't tinkly bells. They clanged. After a brief glower round the room, the man headed for the bar, on a course that would take him past, or probably over, or even through, Sam Vimes. As it was, Vimes carefully pulled his mug out of harm's way, so that the man's undisguised attempt to accidentally spill it failed. "Mr. Jiminy," Vimes called out, "a round of drinks for these gentlemen, all right?" This caused a certain amount of cheerfulness among the other newcomers, but the smith slammed a hand like a shovel down on the wood so that the glasses jumped.
"I don't care to drink with them as grinds the faces of the poor."
Vimes held his gaze and said, "Sorry, I didn't bring my grinder with me today." It was silly, because a couple of sniggers from hopeful drinkers at the bar merely stoked whatever fires the blacksmith had neglected to leave at work and made him angry.
"Who are you to think you're a better man than me?"
Vimes shrugged and said, "I don't know if I'm a better man than you." But he was thinking, "You look to me like a big man in a small community, and you think you're tough because you're strong and metal doesn't sneak up behind you and try and kick you in the ghoulies. Good grief, you don't even know how to stand right. Even Corporal Nobbs could get you down and be kicking you industriously in the fort before you knew what was happening." Like any man, fearing that something expensive could get broken, Jiminy came bustling across the floor and grabbed the smith by one arm, saying, "Come on, Jethro, let's have no trouble. His Grace is just having a drink, the like of which any man is entitled to." This appeared to work, although aggression smouldered on Jethro's face, and indeed in the surrounding air. By the look on the faces of the other men, this was a performance they were familiar with. It was a poor copper who couldn't read a pub crowd, and Vimes could probably write a history with footnotes. Every community has its firebrand, or madman, or self-taught politician. Usually they are tolerated because they add to the gaiety of nations, as it were, and people say things like, "It's just his way," and the air clears and life goes on. But Jethro, now sitting in the far corner of the bar nursing his pipe like a lion huddled over his gazelle, well, Jethro, in the Vimes lexicon of risk, was a man likely to explode. Of course, the world sometimes needed blowing up, just so long as it didn't happen where Vimes was drinking. Vimes was becoming aware that the pub was filling up, mostly with other sons of the soil, but also with people who, whether they were gentlemen or not, would expect to be called so. They wore colourful caps and white trousers and spoke continuously.
There was also further activity outside. Horses and carriages were filling the lane. Hammering was going on somewhere, and Jiminy's wife was now manning, or more correctly, womaning the bar while her husband ran back and forth with his tray. Jethro remained in his corner like a man biding his time, occasionally glaring daggers and probably fists as well, with an option on boots, if Vimes so much as looked at him. Vimes decided to take a look out of the grubby pub window. Regrettably, the pub was that most terrifying of things, picturesque, which meant that the window consisted of small round panes fixed in place with lead. They were for letting the light in, not for looking out of, since they bent light so erratically that it nearly broke. One pane showed what was probably a sheep, but which looked like a white whale until it moved when it became a mushroom. A man walked past with no head until he reached another pane and then had one enormous eyeball. Young Sam would have loved it, but his father decided to give eventual blindness a miss and stepped out into the sunshine. Ah, he thought, some kind of game. Oh, well. Vimes wasn't keen on games because they led to crowds, and crowds led to work for coppers. But here, in fact, he wasn't a copper, was he? It was a strange feeling, so he left the pub and became an innocent bystander. He couldn't remember when he had been one before. It felt vulnerable. He strolled over to the nearest man, who was hammering some stakes into the ground, and asked, "What's going on here, then?" Realising that he had spoken in copper rather than ordinary citizen, he added quickly, "If you don't mind my asking." The man straightened up. He was one of the ones with the colourful caps. "Haven't you ever seen a game of croquet, sir? It's a game of games." Mr. Civilian Vimes did his best to look like a man eager for more delicious information. Judging by his informant's enthusiastic grin, he was about to learn the rules of croquet, whether he wanted to or not. Well, he thought, I did ask. "At first sight, sir, croquet might seem like just another ball game wherein two sides strive against one another by endeavouring to propel the ball by hand or bat or other device into the opponent's goal of some sort. Croquet, however, was invented during a game of croquet at St. Onan's Theological College in Ham on Rye, when the novice priest Jackson Feldfair, now the Bishop of Quirham, took his mallet in both hands, and instead of giving the ball a gentle tap..." After that, Vimes gave up, not only because the rules of the game were incomprehensible in their own right, but also because the extremely enthusiastic young man allowed his enthusiasm to overtake any consideration of the need to explain things in some sensible order, which meant that the flood of information was continually punctuated by apologetic comments along the lines of, "Oh, I'm sorry, I should have explained earlier that a second cone is not allowed more than once per exchange, and in normal play there is only one tump. Unless, of course, you're talking about Royal Croquet." Vimes died. The sun dropped out of the sky, giant lizards took over the world, the stars exploded and went out, and all hope vanished with a gurgle into the sink trap of oblivion, and gas filled the firmament and combusted. Behold, there was a new heaven, one careful owner, and a new disc, and lo, and possibly verily, life crawled out of the sea, or possibly didn't, because it had been made by the gods. That was really up to the bystander. And lizards turned into less scaly lizards, or possibly did not. And lizards turned into birds, and worms turned into butterflies, and a species of apple turned into bananas, and possibly a kind of monkey fell out of a tree and realised that life was better when you didn't have to spend your time hanging on to something. And in only a few million years, evolved trousers and ornamental stripy hats, and lastly, the game of croquet. And there, magically reincarnated, was Vimes, a little dizzy, standing on the village green, looking into the smiling countenance of an enthusiast. He managed to say, "Well, that's amazing. Thank you so very much. I look forward to enjoying the game." At which point, he thought, a brisk walk home might be in order, only to be foiled by a regrettably familiar voice behind him saying, "You, I say, you, yes, you, aren't you Vimes?" It was Lord Rust, usually of Ankh Morpork, and a fierce old warhorse, without whose unique grasp of strategy and tactics several wars would not have been so bloodily won. Now he was in a wheelchair, a new-fangled variety pushed by a man whose life was, knowing his lordship, quite probably unbearable. But hatred tends not to have a long half-life, and in recent years Vimes had regarded the man as now no more than a titled idiot, rendered helpless by age, yet still possessed of an annoying, horsey voice that, suitably harnessed, might be used to saw down trees. Lord Rust was not a problem anymore. There were surely only a few more years to go before he would rust in peace. And somewhere in his knobbly heart, Vimes still retained a slight admiration for the cantankerous old butcher, with his evergreen self-esteem and absolute readiness not to change his mind about anything at all. The old boy had reacted to the fact that Vimes, the hated policeman, was now a duke, and therefore a lot more knobby than he was, by simply assuming that this could not possibly be true, and therefore totally ignoring it. Lord Rust, in Vimes's book, was a dangerous buffoon, but, and here was the difficult bit, an incredibly, if suicidally, brave one. This would have been absolutely tickety-boo were it not for the suicides of those poor fools who followed him into battle. Witnesses had said that it was uncanny. Rust would gallop into the jaws of death at the head of his men and was never seen to flinch, yet arrows and morning stars always missed him, while invariably hitting the men right behind him. Bystanders, or rather people peering at the battle from behind comfortingly large rocks, had testified to this. Perhaps he was capable of ignoring, too, the arrows meant for him. But age could not be so easily upstaged, and the old man, while no less arrogant, had a sunken look. Rust, most unusually, smiled at Vimes and said, "First time I've ever seen you down here, Vimes. Is Sybil going back to her roots, what?" "She wants young Sam to get some mud on his boots, Rust." "Well done her, what? It'll do the boy good and make a man of him, what?" Vimes never understood where the explosive "what" came from. After all, he thought, what's the point of just barking out "what" for absolutely no discernible reason? And as for what? Well, what was all that about? Why what? "What's" seemed to be tent pegs hammered into the conversation. But what the hell's for? What? "So, not down here on any official business then, what?" Vimes's mind spun so quickly that Rust should have heard the wheels go round. It analysed the tone of voice, the look of the man, that slight, ever so slight but nevertheless perceptible hint of a hope that the answer may be no, and presented him with a suggestion that it might not be a bad idea to drop a tiny kitten among the pigeons. He laughed. "Well, Rust, Sybil has been banging on about coming down here since young Sam was born, and this year she put her foot down, and I suppose an order from his wife must be considered official. When?" Vimes saw the man, who pushed the enormous wheelchair, trying to conceal a smile, especially when Rust responded with a baffled, "What?" Vimes decided not to go with "where," and instead said in an offhand way, "Well, you know how it is, Lord Rust. A policeman will find a crime anywhere if he decides to look hard enough." Lord Rust's smile remained, but it had congealed slightly as he said, "I should listen to the advice of your good lady, Vimes. I don't think you'll find anything worth your metal down here." There was no "what" to follow, and the lack of it was somehow an emphasis. It was often a good idea, Vimes had always found, to give the silly bits of the brain something to do, so that they did not interfere with the important ones which had a proper job to fulfil. So, he watched his first game of croquet for a full half hour before an internal alarm told him that shortly he should be back at the hall in time to read to young Sam, something that with any luck did not have "Pooh" mentioned on every page, and tuck him into bed before dinner. His prompt arrival got a nod of approval from Sybil, who gingerly handed him a new book to read to young Sam. Vimes looked at the cover. The title was "The World of Pooh." When his wife was out of eyeshot, he carefully leafed through it. Well, okay, you had to accept that the world had moved on, and these days fairy stories were probably not going to be about twinkly little things with wings. As he turned page after page, it dawned on him that whoever had written this book, they certainly knew what would make kids like young Sam laugh until they were nearly sick. The bit about sailing down the river almost made him smile. But interspersed with the scatology was actually quite interesting stuff about septic tanks and Dunnikin divers and gonfomores and how dog muck helped make the very best leather, and other things that you never thought you would need to know, but once heard somehow lodged in your mind. Apparently, it was by the author of "We," and if young Sam had one vote for the best book ever written, then it would go to "We." His enthusiasm was perhaps fanned all the more because a rare imp of mischief in Vimes led him to do all the necessary straining noises. Later, over dinner, Sybil quizzed him about his afternoon. She was particularly interested when he mentioned stopping by to watch the croquet. "Oh, they still play it. That's wonderful. How did it go?" Vimes put down his knife and fork and stared thoughtfully at the ceiling for a moment or two and then said, "Well, I was talking to Lord Rust for some of the time, and I had to leave, of course, because of young Sam, but fortune favoured the priests when their striker managed to tump a couple of the farmers by a crafty use of the hamper. There were several appeals to the hatman about this, because he broke his malice in so doing, and in my opinion the hatman's decision was entirely correct, especially since the farmers had played a hawk manoeuvre." He took a deep breath. "When play recommenced, the farmers still had not found their stride, but got a breathing space when a sheep wandered onto the pitch, and the priests, assuming that this would stop play, relaxed too soon, and Higgins J. fired a magnificent handsaw under the offending ruminant." Sybil finally stopped him when she realised that the meal was growing very cold, and said, "Sam, how did you become an expert on the noble game of croquet?" Vimes picked up his knife and fork. "Please, don't ask me again," he sighed. In his head, meanwhile, a little voice said, "Lord Rust tells me there is nothing here for me. Oh, dear. I'd better find out what it is. What?" He cleared his throat and said, "Sybil, did you actually look at that book I'm reading to young Sam?" "Yes, dear. Felicity Beadle is the most famous children's writer in the world. She's been at it for years. She wrote Melvin and the Enormous Boil, Geoffrey and the Magic Pillowcase, The Little Duckling Who Thought He Was an Elephant." "Did she write one about an elephant who thought he was a duckling?" "No, Sam, because that would be silly." "Oh, she also wrote Daphne and the Nosepickers, and Gaston's Enormous Problem won for her the Gladys H.J. Ferguson Award, the fifth time she's been given it. She gets children interested in reading, you see." "Yes," said Vimes, "but they're reading about Poe and brain-dead ducklings." "Sam, that's part of the commonality of mankind, so don't be so prudish. Young Sam's a country boy now, and I'm very proud of him. He likes books. That's the whole point. Miss Beadle also finances scholarships for the Quirm College for Young Ladies. She must be quite wealthy now, but I hear she's taken Appletree Cottage. You can practically see it from here. It's on the side of the hill, and I think it's right, if you don't mind, of course, that we invite her here to the hall." "Of course," said Vimes, though his don't-mindedness was entirely due to the way his wife's question had been phrased and the subtle resonances that Miss Beadle's attendance was a done deal. Vimes slept a lot better that night, partly because he could feel that somewhere in the universe nearby there was a clue waiting for him to pull. That made his fingers itch already. In the morning, as he had promised, he took young Sam horse-riding. Vimes could ride, but hated doing so. Nevertheless, falling off the back of a pony onto one's head was a skill that every young man should learn, if only so that he resolved never to do it again. The rest of the day, however, did not work out well. Vimes, suspicions filling his mind, was metaphorically and only just short of literally dragged by Sybil to see her friend Ariadne, the lady blessed with the six daughters. In actual fact, there were only five visible in the chintzy drawing-room when Sybil and he were ushered in. He was feted as the dear brave Commander Vimes. He hated that shit, but under Sybil's benign but careful gaze he was wise enough not to say so, at least not in those precise words. And so he grinned and bore it while they fluttered around him like large moths, and he waved away yet more tea-cakes and cups of tea that would have been welcome were it not that they looked and tasted like what proper tea turns into shortly after you drink it. As far as Sam Vimes was concerned, he liked tea, but tea was not tea if, even before drinking, you could see the bottom of the cup. Still worse than the stuff he was being offered was the conversation, which inclined towards bonnets, a subject on which his ignorance was not just treasured, but venerated. And besides, his breeches were chafing. Wretched things, but Sybil had insisted, saying that he looked very smart in them, just like a country gentleman. Vimes had to suppose that country gentlemen had different arrangements in the groinal department. There was, besides himself and Lady Sybil, a young Omnian curate, wisely dressed in a voluminous black robe, which presumably presented no groinal problems. Vimes had no idea why the young man was there, but presumably the young ladies needed somebody to fill with weak tea, suspect scones, and mindless twittering conversation when someone like Vimes wasn't there. And it seemed that when the subject of bonnets lost its fascination, the only other topics were legacies and the prospects for forthcoming balls. And so, inevitably, given his restlessness in female company, a growing disaffection for urine-coloured tea, and small talk that would barely be visible under a microscope, Vimes said, "Excuse me asking, ladies, but what is it that you actually do for a living, This question elicited 5 genuinely blank looks. Vimes couldn't tell the daughters one from the other, except the one called Emily, who certainly lodged in the mind and possibly also in doorways, and who now said, in the tones of one slightly out of her depth, "I do beg your pardon, Commander, but I don't think we understand what you just vouchsafed.
I meant, well, how do you make a living? Are any of you in employment? How do you make your daily crust? What work do you do?"
Vimes could pick up nothing from Sybil because he couldn't see her face, but the girl's mother was staring at him with gleeful fascination. Oh, well, if he was going to get it in the neck, he might as well get it all the way down.
"I mean, ladies," he said, "how do you make your way in the world? How do you earn your keep? Apart from bonnets, do you have any skills? Like cookery, for example?"
Another daughter, quite possibly Mavis, but Vimes was guessing, cleared her throat and said, "Fortunately, Commander, we have servants for that sort of thing. We're gentlewomen, you see. It would be quite unthinkable for us to go into trade or commerce. A scandal. It's just not done."
By now there appeared to be a competition to see who could terminally baffle who, or possibly whom, first. But Vimes managed to say, "Don't you have a sister in the timber business?"
It was amazing, he thought, that neither their mother nor Sybil was as yet adding anything to the conversation. And now another sister, possibly Amanda, looked about to speak. Why in the world did they all wear those silly diaphanous dresses? You couldn't hope to do a day's work in something as skimpy as that. Amanda, possibly, said carefully,
"I'm afraid our sister is a bit of an embarrassment to the family, Your Grace."
"What, for getting a job? Why?"
Another one of the girls, and Vimes was in fact getting really confused at this point, said,
"Well, Commander, she has no hope of making a good marriage now. Not to a gentleman."
This was becoming a tangle, and so Vimes said, "Tell me, ladies, what is a gentleman?" After some whispered conversation, a sacrificial daughter said, very nervously,
"We understand the gentleman is a man who does not have to sully his hands by working."
Adamantium is said to be the strongest of all metals, but it would have bent around the patience of Sam Vimes, as he said, with every syllable carefully smelted,
"Oh, a layabout! And how do you go about snagging such a gentleman, pray?"
Now the girls looked as if they were indeed praying. One of them managed to say,
"You see, Commander, our dear late father was unlucky in the money market, and I'm afraid that until the death of great Aunt Marigold, of whom we have expectations, there is, alas, no money for a dowry for any of us."
The heavens held their breath while the concept of a dowry was explained to Sam Vimes, and ice formed on the windows as he sat in strangulated thought. At last he cleared his throat and said, "Ladies, the solution to your problem, in my opinion, would be to get off your quite attractive backsides, go out there in the world and make your own way. A dowry? You mean some man has to be paid to marry you? What century do you think you're living in? Is it just me, or is it the most bloody stupid thing you could ever imagine?" He glanced at the beautiful Emily and thought, "Good grief, men would line up on the lawn to fight one another, my dear. How come no one's ever told you? Gentility is all very well, but practicality has its uses. Get out into the world and let the world see you, and it might find a new word in its vocabulary, such as, perhaps, wow." Aloud, he continued, "Honestly, there are lots of jobs out there for a young lady with her wits about her. The Lady Sybil Free Hospital is always on the lookout for sharp girls to train as nurses, for example. Good pay, very fetching uniforms, and a fine chance of snagging a skilled young physician who is on the way to the top, especially if you get your boot behind him. Plus, of course, as a nurse you inherit an amazingly large amount of amusing and embarrassing stories about things which people put... Perhaps this is not the time, but anyway, there is also the possibility of becoming matron if you reach the specified weight. A very responsible job, of use to the community at large, and giving you, at the end of the long day, the satisfaction that you have done some good in the world."
Vimes looked around at the pink and white faces contemplating a jump into the unknown and continued,
"Of course, if you really want to stick with bonnets, then Sybil and I own a decent property in Old Cobblers, in the big city, which is standing empty. Used to be a tough area, but the upwardly mobile trolls and vampires are moving in right now, and the heavy dollar and the dark dollar are not to be sneezed at, especially because they'll pay top dollar for what they want. Quite a sophisticated area, too. People actually put tables and chairs out on the pavement, and they don't always all get stolen. We could let you have it rent-free for 3 months to see how you do, and then maybe you'd have to learn the concept of rent, if only for your self-respect. Trust me, ladies. Self-respect is what you get when you don't have to spend your life waiting for some rich old lady to pop her clogs. Any takers?
Vimes took as an optimistic sign the fact that the girls were staring at one another with what could only be called a wild surmise at the prospect of not being totally useless ornaments, and so he added, "And whatever you do, stop reading bloody silly romantic novels." There was, however, a pocket, or possibly purse, of resistance to the revolution. One girl was standing by the curate, as if she owned him. She looked at Vimes defiantly and said, "Please don't take me forward, Commander, but I'd rather like to marry Jeremy and help him in his ministry."
Very good," said Vimes. "And you love him and he loves you? Speak up, the pair of you."
They both nodded, red with embarrassment, with one eye on the girl's mother, whose wide grin suggested that would be a definite plus.
"Well, then, I suggest you get yourself sorted out, and you, young man, would be advised to find a better-paying job."
"Can't help you with that, but there are loads of religions these days, and if I were you, I'd impress some bishop somewhere with my common sense, which is what a clergyman needs above everything else. Well, nearly everything else. And remember, there's room at the top, although in the case of religion, not right at the top, eh?"
Vimes thought for a moment and added,
"But maybe the best idea, ladies, might be to take a look around a bit until you find some lad that's got the makings of a successful man, noble or not. And if he suits, then get behind him, support him as necessary, helping him up when he's down, and generally being around when he looks for you, and make certain that he'll be around when you look for him. Well, if both of you put your backs into it, then it might turn out to be something good. It has certainly worked once before, hasn't it, Sybil?"
Sybil burst out laughing, and the overwhelmed girls nodded dutifully, as if they actually understood. But Vimes was gratified to feel a gentle little prod from Lady Sybil that offered hope that he was not going to pay too high a price for speaking his mind to these precious flowers. He looked around as if seeking to tidy things up.
"Well, that seems to be that, yes?"
"Excuse me, Commander."
It took Vimes some time to see where the voice had come from. This daughter hadn't spoken a word all afternoon, but had occasionally scribbled in a notebook. Now she gazed at him with a look somewhat brighter than those of her sisters.
"Can I help you, miss? And perhaps you'll tell me your name?"
"Jane, Commander. I'm endeavouring to be a writer. May I ask if you have any views on that as an acceptable career for a young lady?"
Jane, thought Vimes, the strange one. And she was. She was just as demure as the other sisters, but somehow, as he looked at her, he got the impression that she was seeing right through him, thoughts and all. Vimes leaned back in his chair a little defensively and said,
"Well, it can't be a difficult job, given that all the words have probably been invented already, so there's a saving in time right there, considering that you simply have to put them together in a different order."
That was about the limit of his expertise in the literary arts. But he added,
"What sort of thing were you thinking of writing, Jane?"
The girl looked embarrassed.
"Well, Commander, at the moment I'm working on what might be considered a novel about the complexities of personal relationships, with all their hopes and dreams and misunderstandings." She coughed nervously, as if apologising.
Vimes pursed his lips.
"Yes, sounds basically like a good idea, miss, but I can't really help you on that. Though if I was you, and this is me talking off the top of my head, I'd be putting in a lot of fighting and dead bodies falling out of wardrobes, and maybe a war, perhaps, as a bit of background."
Jane nodded uneasily.
"A remarkable suggestion, Commander, with much to recommend it, but possibly the relationships will be somewhat neglected?"
Vimes considered this input and said,
"Well, you might be right."
Then, out of nowhere, possibly some deep hole, a thought struck him, just as it had many times before, sometimes in nightmares.
"I wonder if any author has thought about the relationship between the hunter and the hunted, the policeman and the mysterious killer, the lawman who must think like a criminal sometimes in order to do his job and may be unpleasantly surprised at how good he is at such thinking, perhaps. Just an idea, you understand?" he said lamely, and wondered where the hell it had come from. Maybe the strange Jane had pulled it out of him, and even, perhaps, could resolve it.
"Would anyone like more tea?" said Ariadne brightly.
Lady Sybil was very quiet as her coach drove away, and so Vimes decided to bite the bullet now and get it over with. She was looking thoughtful, which was always worrying.
Am I in trouble, Sybil?"
His wife looked at him blankly for a moment and then said, "Do you mean for telling that bunch of precious blooms to stop yearning for a life and get out there and make one? Good heavens, no. You did everything I would have expected of you, Sam. You always do. I told Ariadne that you wouldn't let her down. She doesn't have much of an income, and if you hadn't given them the righteous word, I think she would have eventually driven them out with a shovel. No, Sam, I just wonder what goes on in your head, that's all. I mean, I'm sure some people think being a policeman is just a job, but you don't, do you? I'm very proud of you, Sam, and wouldn't have you any other way, but I do worry sometimes. Anyway, well done. I'll look forward with interest to see what young Jane writes."
Next day, Vimes took his little boy fishing, hampered somewhat by a total lack of knowledge of the art. Young Sam didn't seem to mind. He had located a shrimping net among the largesse of the nursery, and messed about in the shadows, chasing crayfish and sometimes going almost rigid in order to stare at things. Once he got over the shock, Vimes noticed that young Sam did this quite happily, and on one occasion pointed out to his doting father things in the stream, like insects in the water with a coat made of little pebbles, which Vimes had to investigate to find that this was entirely true. This amazed Sam Vimes even more than it did his son, who in fact, he told his father as they strolled back for lunch, had been really looking to see if fish did a poo, a question that had never exercised Sam Vimes in his life, but appeared to be of great importance to his son. So much so that on the way home he had to be restrained from doubling back to the stream to see if they got out to do it, because otherwise, yuck. Sybil had promised young Sam another trip around Home Farm in the afternoon, which left Sam Vimes to his own devices, or such devices as the policeman could find in the quiet lanes. Vimes was streetwise. He didn't know what lane-wise might entail, but possibly it would deal with things like throttling stoats and knowing whether whatever it was that had just said moo was a cow or a bull without having to bend down to find out. And, as he walked around his rolling acres on his aching feet, wishing that there were cobblestones under him, once again he could feel the tingle that raises little hairs on a copper's neck when his well-honed senses tell him that there was something happening around here that shouldn't be, and was crying out to have something done about it. But there was another copper here, wasn't there? A real old flatfoot let out to grass, but being a copper stained you to the bone, you never got rid of it. He smiled. Time, perhaps, to go for a convivial drink with Mr. Jiminy. The Goblin's Head was bare of customers at this time of day, except the ever-present trio on the bench outside. Vimes seated himself at the bar with a glass of Mrs. Jiminy's root beer and leaned confidentially towards the barman. "So, Mr. Jiminy, what's of interest here to an old copper?" Jiminy opened his mouth, but Vimes went on, "Rosewood Truncheon Pseudopolis City Watch. I know I'm right. It's no crime. That's the copper's dream. And you take your trusty truncheon with you to have a little friend you can depend on if the customer can't hold his liquor and won't take a hint." Vimes was now settled with one elbow on the bar and doodling on a small puddle of spilt beer. "But the job follows you, doesn't it? And if you run a pub, well, that goes double, because you hear all sorts of things. Things you don't do anything about because you aren't a copper anymore, except you know you are. But it must worry you somewhere in your soul that there are things going wrong in these parts. Even I can tell. It's the copper's nose. I can smell it in the air. It comes up through my boots. Secrets and lies, Mr. Jiminy, secrets and lies." Jiminy made a point of wiping his cloth over the spilt beer and said, as if absent-mindedly, "You know, Commander Vimes, things are different in the country. People think that the country is where you can go to hide out. It ain't so. In the city, you're a face in the crowd. In the country, people will stare at you until you're out of sight, just for the entertainment value. Like you say, I'm not a copper anymore. I ain't got a warrant card, and I ain't got the inclination. And now, if you don't mind, I have some work to do. There'll be more customers soon. Watch where you tread, Your Grace." Vimes didn't let him off the hook. "Interesting thing, Mr. Jiminy. I know you have the lease on this pub, but, amazingly enough, I'm still your landlord. I'm sorry about that, but before we came down here, I looked at the map and I saw a pub on our land, and what a waste, I thought, but that makes me your landlord. Not very republican of me, I know, but I just wonder, Mr. Jiminy, if it may be that not everyone in these parts is that keen on having the commander of the city watch down here in this quiet little hideaway, hmm?" An image of poor old Lord Rust artlessly telling him that there was nothing here of interest passed across Vimes's inner vision.
Jiminy's expression was frozen, but Vimes, who knew this game, saw that tiny twitch which, when decoded, meant, "Yes, but I didn't say anything, and no one can prove I did, not even you, my friend." Further discussion on the point was interrupted when the Sons of the Soil began to come in, one by one, to celebrate the ending of the working day. This time there was less suspicion in their eyes as they nodded to Vimes en route to the bar, and so he sat, nursing his pint of spiced-up beetroot juice, and just enjoyed the moment. It was a very short moment, at the end of which the blacksmith swaggered into the bar and walked straight up to him.
"You're sitting in my seat!"
Vimes looked around. He was sitting on a bench that was indistinguishable from all the others in the room, but he accepted the possibility that there was something mystic about the one he was occupying, picked up his glass, and strolled over to an unoccupied one, where he sat down just in time to hear the blacksmith say,
"That one's my seat too, understand?"
Oh dear. Here was the overture and beginners to a brawl, and Vimes was no beginner, right enough, and the blacksmith's eyes held the look of a man who wanted to punch somebody, and very likely thought that Vimes would make the ideal candidate. He felt the gentle pressure of his own brass knuckles in his trouser pocket. Vimes had been economical with the truth when he promised his wife that he would not take any weapons on holiday with him. However, he'd reasoned that a knuckle duster was not so much a weapon as a way of making certain that he stayed alive. It could be called a defensive instrument, a kind of shield, as it were, especially if you needed to get your defence in before you were attacked. He stood up. "Mr. Jethro, I'd be grateful if you'd be so kind as to choose which chair is yours for the evening, thank you very much, after which I intend to enjoy my drink in peace." Whoever said that a soft answer turneth away wrath had never worked in a bar. The blacksmith glowered at about the same temperature as his forge.
"I ain't Jethro to you, not by a long way. You can call me Mr. Jefferson, do you hear?
And you can call me Sam Vimes." He watched Jefferson very deliberately place his drink on the bar before he strode towards Vimes.
"I know what I can call you, mister."
Vimes felt the smooth brass of the surrogate knuckles, polished as they had been by years of abrasion from his pants, and, needless to say, the occasional chin. As he dug down, they almost leapt to his grasp.
"Sorry about this, Your Grace," said Jiminy, as he pushed him gently out of the way and said to the smith, "Well, now, Jethro, what's this all about, then?" "Your Grace!" sneered Jethro. "I ain't going to call you that. I ain't going to lick your boots like all the others do. Coming back here, lording it over us, ordering us about as if you owned the place. That's it, isn't it? You do own a place. One man with all this country, that's not right. You tell me how did that happen. Go on, you tell me."
Vimes shrugged.
"Well, I'm not an expert, but as I understand it, my wife's ancestors fought somebody for it."
The blacksmith's face bloomed with an evil pleasure as he threw off his leather apron.
"Well, okay, no problem. That's how it's done, is it? Fair enough. Tell you what I'll do. I'll fight you for it, here and now. And tell you what I'll do, I'll fight you with one hand strapped behind my back on account of you being a bit shorter than me."
Vimes heard a slight wooden sound behind him. It was the sound of a barman stealthily pulling a 2-foot-long rosewood truncheon from its accustomed place under the bar. Jethro must have heard it too, because he called out,
"And don't you try anything with that, Jim. You know I'll have it out of your hands before you know what's happening, and this time I'll shove it where the sun don't shine."
Vimes took a look at the rest of the clientele, who were doing remarkable impersonations of stone statues.
"Look," he said, "you really don't want to fight me." "I do, indeed I do. You said it yourself. Some ancestor got all of this by fighting for it, yeah? Who said it's the time to stop fighting?"
"Burlier and stronger the arm, sir," said a polite yet chilly voice behind the big man. To Vimes's shock, it was Willikins. "I'm not cruel, sir. I won't shoot you in the guts, but I will make you realise how much you took your toes for granted. No, please do not make any sudden movements. Burly and strong in the arm crossbows have notoriously responsive triggers." Vimes resumed breathing again when Jethro raised his hands. Somewhere in all that rage there must have been a halfpenny worth of self-preservation. Nevertheless, the blacksmith glared at him and said,
"You need to be protected by a hired killer, do you?"
"In point of fact, sir," said Willikin smoothly, "I am employed by Commander Vimes as gentleman's gentleman, and I require this crossbow because sometimes his socks fight back." He looked at Vimes. "Do you have any instructions, Commander?" And then he shouted, "Don't move, mister, because as far as I know, a blacksmith needs two hands to work with."
He turned back to Vimes. "Do excuse that interjection, Commander, but I know his sort."
"Willikins, I rather think you are his sort."
"Yes, sir, thank you, sir. But I wouldn't trust me one little inch, sir. I knows a bad one when I sees them. I have a mirror."
"Now, I want you to put that bloody thing down, Willikins. People could get hurt," Vimes said in his formal voice.
"Yes, sir, that would have been my intention. I could not face her ladyship if anything happened to you."
Vimes looked from Willikins to Jethro. Here was a boil that needed lancing. But you couldn't blame the lad. It wasn't as if he hadn't thought the same way himself many times. "Willikins," he said, "please put that wretched thing down carefully and get out your notebook. Thank you. Now, please write down as follows. I, Samuel Vimes, somewhat reluctantly the Duke of Ankh, do intend to duke it out, ha-ha, with my friend Jethro. What's your full name again, Jethro?"
"Now look here, mister, I didn't... I asked you your damned name, mister. Jiminy, what's his surname?"
"Jefferson," said the landlord, holding his truncheon like a security blanket. "But look, Your Grace, you don't want to go..." Vimes ignored him and went on. "Now where was I? Oh, yes. My friend Jethro Jefferson, in a friendly fight for the ownership of the manor and environs, whatever the hell they are, which will go to the which of us that does not first cry uncle. And should it be myself that utters the same, there will be no repercussions of any sort upon my friend Jethro, or on my man Willikins, who pleaded with me not to engage in this friendly bout of fisticuffs. Got that, Willikins? I'll even give you a get-out-of-jail-free card to show her ladyship if I get bruised. Now give it to me to sign."
Willikins handed over the notebook with reluctance. "I don't think it'll work on her ladyship, sir. Look, dukes aren't expected to go around..." His voice faltered in the face of Vimes's smile.
"You were going to say that dukes shouldn't fight, weren't you, Willikins? And if you had, I would have said that the word duke absolutely means that you do fight."
"Oh, very well, sir," said Willikins. "But perhaps you ought to warn him..."
Willikins was interrupted by the pub's customers, pushing their way out at speed and running through the village, leaving Jethro standing alone and bewildered. Halfway towards the man, Vimes turned to look back at Willikins and said, "You may think you see me lighting a cigar, Willikins, but on this occasion I think your eyes may turn out to be at fault. Do you understand?"
"Yes, and in fact I am deaf as well, Commander."
"Good lad. Now let's get outside where there's less glass and a better view." Jethro looked like a man who had had the ground cut from under his feet but didn't know how to fall down. Vimes lit his cigar and savoured, just for a moment, the forbidden fruit. Then he offered the packet to the blacksmith, who waved it away without a word. "Very sensible," said Vimes. "Now then, I'd better tell you that at least once a week, even these days, I have to fight people who are trying to kill me with everything from swords to chairs and, in one case, a very large salmon. They probably don't actually want to kill me, but they'll try to stop me arresting them. Look," he waved a hand at the landscape in general, "all this stuff just happened, whether I wanted it to or not. By trade, I'm just a copper."
"Yeah," said Jethro, glaring at him, "stamping on the faces of the struggling masses."
Vimes was used to this sort of thing and put it mildly. "Can't tread on their faces these days. My grinder gets in the way." "All right, not very funny, I admit." Vimes was aware that people were coming back down the lane. They included women and children. It looked as though the pub's clientele had roused the neighbourhood. He turned to Jethro. "Are we going to do this by the Marquis of Fantailor's rules?"
"What are they?"
said the blacksmith, waving at the oncoming horde. "Rules of sparring by the Marquis of Fantailor," said Vimes.
"If they was written by a marquis, I don't want no chuck with them."
Vimes nodded. "Willikins?"
"I heard that, Commander, and have recorded it in my notebook. Refused Fantailor."
"Well then, Mr. Jefferson," said Vimes, "I suggest we ask Mr. Jiminy to start the proceedings."
"I want your lackey to write down in that book of his that my mum won't get put out of her cottage whatever happens, right?"
"It's a deal," said Vimes. "Willikins, please make a memorandum that Mr. Jefferson's old mum should not be thrown out of her cottage, hit with sticks, put in the stocks, or otherwise manhandled in any way. Understand?"
Willikins, trying ineffectually to hide a smile, licked his pencil and wrote industriously. Vimes, less noisily, made a mental note, and the note said, "The ferocity is draining out of this lad. He is wondering if he actually might get killed. I haven't thrown a punch, not one little punch, and he is already preparing for the worst."
"Of course, the right way to go about it is to prepare for the best." The crowd was growing by the second.
Even as Vimes looked on, people came down the lane carrying a very old man on a mattress, their progress accelerated by his delight in hitting them on the back of the legs with his walking stick. Mothers towards the back of the crowd were holding up their children for a better look, and all unknown, every man had a weapon. It was like a peasant's revolt, without the revolt, and with a very polite class of peasant. Men touched their forelocks when Vimes looked in their direction. Women curtsied, or at least bobbed up and down a bit, disturbingly out of sequence like organ pedals trembling. Jiminy approached Vimes, and the blacksmith cautiously, and to judge by the glistening of his face, very apprehensively. "Now then, gents, I'm choosing to consider this a little demonstration of fisticuffs, a jolly trial of strength and prowess, such as may be found on any summer evening, old friends under the skin, okay?" There was a pleading look in his eyes as he went on. "And when you've got it out of your systems, there'll be a pint waiting for each of you on the bar. Please don't break anything." He produced an overused handkerchief from a waistcoat pocket and held it in the air. "When this touches the ground, gentlemen," he said, backing away very quickly. The slip of linen seemed to defy gravity for a while, but the moment it touched the ground, Vimes caught the blacksmith's boot in both hands as it swung towards him, and said, very quietly to the struggling man, "A bit previous, weren't you? And what good has it done you? Hear them all sniggering? I'll let you off this time." Vimes gave a push as he loosened his grip on the foot, causing Jethro to stagger backwards. Vimes felt a certain pleasure in seeing the man losing it this early, but the blacksmith pulled himself together and rushed at him, and paused, possibly because Vimes was grinning. "That's the ticket, my lad," said Vimes. "You just saved yourself a dreadful pain in the unmentionables." He made fists and beckoned suggestively to his bewildered adversary over the top of his left fist. The man came swinging and got a kick on the kneecap, which floored him, and he was picked up by Vimes, which metaphorically floored him again. "Why ever did you think I was going to box? That's what we professionals call misdirection. You want to go for the hug? I would if I were a big bloke like you, but you ain't going to get the chance." Vimes shook his head sorrowfully. "Should have gone for the Marquis of Fantaylor. I believe that has been carved on many a gravestone." He took a generous pull of his cigar. The ash had yet to be disturbed. Enraged beyond belief, Jethro threw himself at Vimes and caught a glancing blow to his head, receiving at almost the same time a knee in the stomach which knocked all the breath out of him. They went down together with Vimes as a conductor of this orchestra. He made certain he ended on top, where he leaned down and hissed into Jethro's ear. "Let's see how smart you are, shall we? Are you a man who can control his temper? Because if you aren't, then I'll give you a nose so wide that you'll have to hold your handkerchief on the end of a stick. Don't you, for one moment, think I'm not capable of it. But I reckon a blacksmith knows when to cool the metal. And I'm giving you a chance to say that at least you got the Duke on the floor in front of all your friends, and we'll stand up and shake hands like the gentleman neither of us is, and the crowd will cheer and go into the pub and get happily ratted on the beer that I shall pay for. Are we men of one accord?" There was a muffled "Yes," and Vimes stood up, took the blacksmith's hand in his, and raised it up high, which caused some slight puzzlement. But when he then said, "Sam Vimes invites you all to take a drink with him in Mr. Jiminy's establishment," everybody shrugged bewilderment aside to make room for the beer. The crowd surged into the pub, leaving the blacksmith and Vimes on their own, plus Willikins, who could be remarkably self-effacing when he wanted. "Blacksmiths should know about temper, too," said Vimes, as the crowd dispersed pubwards. "Sometimes cool is better than hot. I don't know anything much about you, Mr. Jefferson, but the City Watch needs people who learn fast, and I reckon you would soon make it the sergeant. We could use you as a smith, too. It's amazing how dented the old armour can get when you're standing on the faces of the poor." Jethro stared down at his boots. "All right, you can beat me in a fight. That doesn't mean it's right, all right? You don't know the half of it." There were sounds of merriment coming from the pub. Vimes wondered how embroidered that little scuffle would turn out to be. He turned back to the smith, who hadn't moved. "Listen to me, you stupid young fool. I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. When I was a kid, the only spoons I ever saw were made of wood, and you were lucky if there was some edible food on the end of them. I was a street kid, understand? If I'd been dumped out here, I would have thought it was paradise, what with food jumping out on you from every edge. But I became a copper because they paid you, and I was taught how to be a copper by decent coppers, because believe me, mister, I wake every night knowing I could have been something else. And then I found a good lady. And if I were you, kid, I'd hope that I'd find one of them too.
So I smartened myself up, and then one day Lord Vetinari, you have heard of him, haven't you, kid? Well, he needed a man to get things done, and the title opens doors so that I don't actually have to kick them open myself. And you know what? I reckon my boots have seen so much crime down the years that they walk me towards it of their own accord, and I know there's something that needs kicking. So do you, I can smell it on you. Tell me what it is.
Jethro still stared at his own boots and said nothing. Willikins cleared his throat.
I wonder, Commander, if it might help if I had a little talk with the young man from what you might call a less elevated position. Why don't you take a look at the beauties of the local countryside?
Vimes nodded.
By all means, if you think it'll do some good.
And he went away and examined a honeysuckle hedge with considerable interest, while Willikins, with his shiny gentleman's gentleman shoes and his immaculate jacket, strolled over to Jethro, put an arm round him and said,
"This is a stiletto I'm holding to your throat, and it ain't no lady's shoe. This is a real thing, the cutting edge, as it were. You are a little twit, and I ain't the commander, and I will slice you to the bone if you make a move. Got that? Now don't nod your head."
"Good. We are learning, aren't we?
Now, my lad, the commander here is trusted by the Diamond King of Trolls and the Low King of the Dwarfs, who would only have to utter a word for your measly carcass to come under the caress of a large number of versatile axes, and by Lady Margalotta of Uberwald, who trusts very few people, and by Lord Vetinari of Ankh-Morpork, who doesn't trust anybody at all. Got that? Don't nod. And you, my little man, have the damn nerve to doubt his word. I'm an easy-going sort of fellow, but that sort of thing leaves me right out of sorts, I don't mind telling you. You understand?
I said, do you understand?
All right, you can nod now.
Incidentally, young man, be careful who you call a lackey, all right? Some people might take violent exception to that sort of thing.
A word to the wise lad. I know the commander, and you thought about your old mum and what might happen to her, and I reckon that is why I won't be seeing you in Lavender, because he is a sensitive soul at heart.
Willikin's knife disappeared as quickly as it had come, and with the other hand the gentleman's gentleman produced a small brush and tidied the blacksmith's collar.
"Willikins," said Vimes from the distance, "will you go for a little walk now, please?"
When his manservant was loitering under a tree a little way further up the lane, Vimes said,
"Sorry about that, but every man has his pride.
I bear that in mind, so should you.
I'm a copper, a policeman, and something here is calling to me. It seems to me that you have something you'd like me to know, and it's not just about who sits in the High Castle. Am I right? Something bad has happened. You are practically sweating it. Well?"
Jethro leaned towards him and said, "Dead man's cops, on the hill, midnight. I won't wait." The blacksmith then turned around and walked away without a glance behind.
Vimes lit a fresh cigar and strolled towards the tree where Willikins was appearing to enjoy the landscape.
He straightened up when he saw Vimes.
"We'd better get a move on, sir. Dinner is at 8 o'clock, and her ladyship would like you to be smart. She sets a lot of store by your being smartly turned out, sir."
Vimes groaned. "Not the official tights."
"Happily not, sir, not in the country. But her ladyship was very specific about my bringing the plum-coloured evening dress, sir."
"She says it makes me look dashing," said Vimes morosely.
"Do you think it makes me look dashing? Am I a dashing kind of person, were you saying?"
The birds started singing from a low branch of the tree.
"I'd put you down as a more the sprinting sort, sir," said Willikins.
They set off home, in silence for a while, which is to say that neither man spoke, while wildlife sang, buzzed, and screeched, eventually causing Vimes to say, "I wish I knew what the hell all those things are." Willikins put his head on one side for a moment and then said,
"Parkinson's warbler, the deep-throated frog-eater, and common creed waggler, sir."
"You know?"
"Oh, yes, sir. I frequent the music halls, sir, and there's always a bird or animal impersonator on the bill. It tends to stick. I also know 73 farmyard noises, my favourite of which is the sound of a farmer who has had one boot sucked from his foot by the muck he's trying to avoid, and has nowhere else to put his stockinged foot but in the said muck. Hugely amusing, sir."
They had reached a long drive to the hall now, and gravel crunched beneath their boots. Under his breath, Vimes said, "I've arranged to meet young Mr. Jefferson at midnight in the copse on Hangman's Hill. He wishes to tell me something important. Remind me, Willikins, what is a copse exactly?"
"Anything between a clump of trees and a small wood. Technically, sir, the one at the top of Hangman's Hill is a beech hanger. That just means, well, a small beech wood on top of a hill. You remember Mad Jack Ramkin, the bloke that got it made 30 feet higher at great expense?
he had the beech trees planted on the top. Vimes liked the crunching of the gravel. It would mask the sound of their conversation. "I talked to the blacksmith with, I would swear, no one else in earshot, but this is the country, yes, Willikins?" "There was a man setting rabbit snares in the hedge behind you," said Willikins. "Perfectly normal activity, although to my mind he took too long over it." They crunched onwards for a while, and Vimes said, "Tell me, Willikins, if a man had arranged to meet another man at midnight in a place with a name like Dead Man's Copse on Hangman's Hill, what would you consider to be his most sensible course of action, given that his wife had forbidden him to bring weapons to his country house?" Willikins nodded. "Why, sir, given your maxim that everything is a weapon if you choose to think of it as such, I would advise said man to see whether he has a compatriot, what has, for example, acquired the keys to a cabinet that contains a number of superbly made carving knives, ideal for close fighting. And I personally would include a side order of cheese wire, sir, in conformance with my belief that the only important thing in a fight to the death is that the death should not be yours." "Can't carry cheese wire, man? Not the commander of the watch?" "Quite so, commander. And may I therefore advise your brass knuckles, the gentleman's alternative? I know you never travel without them, sir. There's some vicious people around, and I know you have to be among them. Look, Willikins, I don't like to involve you in all this. It's only a hunch, after all." Willikins waved this away. "You wouldn't keep me out of it for a big clock, sir, because all this is tickling my fancy as well. I shall lay out a selection of cutting edges for you in your dressing room, sir, and I myself will go up to the copse half an hour before you're due to be there with my trusty bow and an assortment of favourite playthings. It's nearly a full moon, clear skies, there'll be shadows everywhere, and I'll be standing in the darkest one of them." Vimes looked at him for a moment and said, "Could I please amend that suggestion? Could you not be there in the second darkest shadow 1 hour before midnight to see who steps into the darkest shadow?" "Ah, yes, that's why you command the watch, sir," said Willikins. And to Vimes' shock, there was a hint of a tear in the man's voice. "You're listening to the street, aren't you, sir, yes?" Vimes shrugged. "No streets here, Willikins." Willikins shook his head. "Once a street boy, always a street boy, sir. It comes with us in the pinch. Mothers go, fathers go, if we ever knew who they were. But the street, well, the street looks after us. In the pinch, it keeps us alive." Willikins darted ahead of Vimes and rang the doorbell, so that the footman had the door open by the time Vimes came up to the steps. "You've got just enough time to listen to young Sam read to you, sir," Willikins added, making his way up the stairs. "Wonderful thing, reading. I wish I'd learned it when I was a kid. Her ladyship will be in her dressing room, and guests will be arriving in about half an hour." "Must go, sir. I've got to teach that fat toad of a butler his manners, sir." Vimes winced. "You're not allowed to strangle butlers, Willikins. I'm sure I read it in the Book of Etiquette." Willikins gave him a look of mock offence. "No garrotting will be involved, sir," he said, opening the door to Vimes's dressing room. "But he is a snob of the first water. Never did meet a butler who wasn't. I just have to give him an orientation lesson." "Well, he is the butler, and this is his house," said Vimes. "No, sir, it's your house. And since I am your personal manservant, I, by the irrevocable laws of the servants' hall, outrank every one of the lazy buggers. I'll show them how we do things in the real world, sir, don't you worry." He was interrupted by a heavy knock at the door, followed by a determined rattling of the doorknob. Willikins opened the door, and young Sam stomped in and announced, "Reading!" Vimes picked up his son and sat him on a chair. "How was your afternoon, my lad?" "Do you know," said young Sam, as if imparting the results of strict research, "cows do really big floppy poos, but sheep do small poos, like chocolates." Vimes tried not to look at Willikins, who was shaking with suppressed laughter. He managed to keep his own expression solemn and said, "Well, of course, sheep are smaller." Young Sam considered this. "Cow poos go flop," he said. "It never said that in Where's My Cow?" Young Sam's voice betrayed a certain annoyance that this important information had been withheld. "Miss Felicity Beadle wouldn't have let it out." Vimes sighed. "I just bet she wouldn't." Willikins opened the door. "I'll leave you gentlemen to it, then, and see you later, sir." "Willikins," said Vimes, just as the man had his hand on the doorknob, "you appear to think that my brass knuckles are inferior to yours, is that so?" Willikins smiled. "You've never really agreed with the idea of the spiked ones, have you, sir?" He carefully shut the door behind him.